This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. A few years ago, one of our guests suggested as the climate destabilized, the world economy could go down with it. With one weather disaster following another, it costs more trying to recover than a country can produce or tax its citizens. Eventually, decades away, there would be no money for recovery. Governments would become incapable and bankrupt. That time is now. After a year of record snowstorms, record drought and fires, record tornadoes, remember all those? And now a hurricane of the century, the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is broke. Already, municipal and state governments were teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. They sold more bonds this year only due to federal guarantees. Now, after the debt ceiling fiasco and a downgrade by Moody's, even the mass media admits America is going broke. Lurking behind, driving energy and extreme rainfall into the clouds, while drying a quarter of the U.S. nation into worse than Dust Bowl times, the carbon engine of climate change continues to power up. All over the world, for Canadians, for people in China and India, and especially for people in Australia. Next week, we'll do our official kickoff for the fall season of EcoShock. I've got a lineup of guests with gusto and guts. This week is really for our dedicated fans and anyone else who will listen. We have a new speech by the world's most influential climate scientist. He works with European heads of state. He receives delegations from China. Recently, he advised the White House. This is a powerful mind at the vortex of the most recent and urgent scientific research into the new climate you and I are making. He was the chief organizer of the third assessment report for the IPCC. For all the institutions and panels he heads, most North Americans have never heard his name, unless they subscribe to a YouTube Uber conspiracy channel, perhaps, where he is villainized. Hans Joachim Schellenhuber, known as John to his English-speaking friends. That's the name, Schellenhuber. Among other things, he was research director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research in Britain, an awe-inspiring position. Now he is director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, also known as PIC, and on the side, a chair for theoretical physics at the University of Potsdam, Germany. Schellenhuber advised the German Chancellor on climate science. In September 2009, John Schellenhuber was a presenter at the first conference convened to consider the worst, a world where temperature rises beyond our current ecology, a world without ice anywhere. It was called 4 Degrees and Beyond at Oxford University. In July 2011, Schellenhuber gave two keynote speeches for the second such conference, this time in Melbourne, Australia. His public speech is available with video on the net at 4degrees2011.com.au. 4degrees2011.com.au. I'll put that link in my blog for this program at ecoshock.info. Make sure you listen or see that speech. There is a lot of important information you have not heard, partly because it is so new. Some of it you will not hear on this program either, because I want you to hear the speech he gave to the university conference audience. It is raw and disturbing. I'm almost hesitant to pass it on. We all need to know where we are going when we set out for a drive, flick a switch, use the buried fossil power from the distant past. From the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia, courtesy of the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute and other sponsors, both public and private, this keynote address for experts has been lightly edited for radio time. The title, Strange Encounters Behind the 2 Degrees Firewall. Here is Professor Hans Joachim Schellenhuber.
Trying to protect the climate, trying to make your domestic national contribution to saving the planet must not mean necessarily that we will be all deindustrialized and poverty-stricken and the end of the world will coming soon, quite to the contrary. Anyway, I'll talk about that later. So let me start here. Strange encounters behind the 2 degrees fireball. Why so? Of course we can talk about 4 degrees and 5 degrees and 6 degrees, but you know that there is an international agreement, and actually this is a miracle in its own, confirmed in Cancun during the latest climate conference, that we have a quantitative climate protection target. If you go back to the UN Convention on Climate Change, which was sealed in 1992 in Rio, this was a very vague statement. Let's avoid somehow dangerous climatic change, whatever that means. That is worth almost nothing. And the scientific community, together with all the committed people in business, in civil society, and in policy making, have struggled for almost 20 years in order to get a quantitative target established. Now, 2 degrees does not mean below 2 degrees everything is fine and beyond that it's the end of the world. It's not a hard scientific target, but it is one which is a fairly reasonable compromise between feasibility and desirability, as I will outline later on. So, what can we expect to happen behind that firewall? It is a firewall because, in a sense, you sacrifice some space, which is on our side of the firewall. It would be much better, in particular for the Pacific Islands, to have no global warming at all, if we could achieve that. Because 2 degrees in the long run means the vanishing of many island communities. So the Maldives are lost if we keep to the 2 degrees target. That is a very bitter truth. But if we would go beyond that, if we would not have even that firewall, we might even risk the end of a higher form of civilization on this planet. So that's the rationale of a firewall. What is going to happen behind that wall? Okay, let me start, and first let me review what I call the current past of climate change. And when you talk about that, it's always very important to go to decadal averages. And this is a very nice plot produced by Jim Hansen's group at Columbia University, which shows you simply in the last 4 decades, over the last 4 decades, how the planet has warmed up as compared to average regional temperatures. So you have a geographically explicit plot here, and it's called the temperature anomaly. And you see it means more or less that over the 4 decades, the planet has warmed up by just 0.5 degrees. Now, people often make jokes about it and say, well, difference between day and night or flying to Brisbane or whatever is much, much bigger. But when I, in general, respond by telling them, but if you think of your body temperature and you would have 2 degrees warming, that means you have fever, or 4 degrees means you are dead. So we're talking about the body temperature of our planet, actually, which is a sort of self-controlled feedback system. And if you disturb that in such a dramatic way, even half a degree makes a huge difference. It means the planet, even within these 4 decades, has sort of developed a very slight form of fever already. But the other interesting thing is the regional differences. So you can spot Australia here, but even more interesting are the things I'm going to talk about also later is the West Antarctic Peninsula and Greenland. So if you focus on Greenland, you see no anomaly or even a cooler than average situation in the 1970s. Nothing happened in the 1980s. But here, over the last decade, Greenland has warmed up tremendously. While with the West Antarctic Peninsula, you see it was already developing an anomaly in the 1970s, and that has sort of continued, and now it's one of the, compared to average, sort of fastest warming up regions in the world, with a number of impacts to be expected. Now, when it comes to global mean temperature, people often say warming is sort of accelerating at the global level. That is not true. It is just within the range of IPCC prediction. So you have this wobbly line, so the black curve is the observation, goes up and down. It is coupled to El Niño suffer oscillation and many other things, not so much the solar variations. They are in the range of 0.1 degree centigrade, more or less. So even if the sun is not active over the next decade, it doesn't play a big role in the climate. And you see it's going up and down. These are various data sets. But more or less in 2010, we are on track, more or less, with the predictions of the IPCC. The most interesting thing probably is not on this slide, but not only was 2010 more or less the warmest year on record, it was also the wettest year on record. Oh, that's an interesting thing. Because according to very fundamental physics, Clausius-Clapeyron equation or things like that, we should have, of course, a strengthening of the global hydrological cycle when we're warming up this planet. The problem is that the precipitation will not come in a uniform way all over the planet, but the more arid regions will become even more arid in the future, and the wetter regions will become even more wet, simply because we have a cell structure on this planet, and the cell structure, the Hadley cell, feral cell, the polar cell, gets strengthened. The circulation is getting strengthened in general, and that means the precipitation injustice on this planet will be increased. Now, here is a trend which is accelerating clearly, that is Arctic sea ice extent. So you see various numbers here. So you have average here, you have the last years. Actually, 2011 was on a record course here. Now it seems that the ice is regrowing a little bit faster. Now, the interesting thing, it was said when I was trained in theoretical physics and mathematics, so there was an interesting paper in Physics Today very recently asking if we have this trend of acceleration of sea level, sea ice reduction, people tried to calculate it, what it really needs to reduce the sea ice cover in the Arctic. And the big puzzle is why it didn't melt much faster. Because if you have just 1 watt per square meter perturbation, when it should melt like this, but with reorientation of ocean currents and so on, and warmer sea water, in some places where there was a perturbation of up to 10 watts per square meter. So the ice is still there. That is amazing, but it's not a very comforting insight, actually. So we could see much more surprises in this context. And then, of course, very important when we talk about sea level rise, the combined contribution of Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet. And here you clearly see, again, a wobbly line, but a trend towards deglaciation. And it means, in the end, that by the mid-century, there will be at least a contribution to global sea level of 15 centimeters by the ice sheet. Now, this is not covered by the last IPCC report, and I'm afraid that it will not be covered either by the next IPCC report. We tried to create various research projects in order to create evidence which goes into the fifth assessment report. But you know, the IPCC, although people may say differently here in Australia, I understand you have a very vital skeptics community here. The IPCC is an extremely conservative network of scholars, actually. And the last projection on sea level rise was, you know, maybe 25 centimeters or something by the end of the century. But there was a little footnote. The small print said the contribution of the big ice sheets is not considered at all. Why? Not because something will not happen, but simply the scientific evidence seemed not to be strong enough to put any bounds on it. It seems now that we are doing much better, but I'm still skeptical in a different way that the IPCC will include all the latest evidence on the ice sheet contribution. And here, CO2 emissions. If you feel that there is any relationship between carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and global warming, this is very bad news, because The financial crisis created a dip in global emissions, but we are back on track. And actually, if you look at the latest International Energy Agency predictions on industry-related emissions, there will be a record increase of CO2 emissions of 5% or something. So we are going over the top, really, in this context. Anyway, so that is the past future, the last IPCC report I mentioned already. So this is the famous fan of various scenarios, A1, B2, and so on, which would produce different climate futures, and in particular important because this is more or less business as usual, an additional warming by the end of the century of 2 or 3 degrees, on top of the 0.7, 0.8 we have already experienced since 1900. But this is the past future. There is a current future as well. Now, if you assume, and in particular, if you assume in spite of the carbon tax, which was announced, I guess, 2 days ago here in Australia, I think it's a good working hypothesis to assume that the world is not going to end by the year 2100. I think that's true. And that was a joke again, just for your information. So, if the world is not going to end by 2100, it would be fairly appropriate to look beyond that date. And that's what you get. Now, that's a fairly complicated thing. Now, I owe a number of inputs to my colleague Malte Meinshausen, who I guess is here. Malte, are you here? Welcome to Australia. So he has provided a lot of very interesting analysis. I picked this one called the representative concentration pathway. So a new set of scenarios. What is going to happen regarding emissions? And this is the small panel here. You see fossil CO2 emissions till the year 2300. That's very important, actually. And you have a number of scenarios. This is the worst-case scenario, but all of these scenarios are self-consistent, if you like. So these are not fairy tales, but consistent narratives of the future, of the industrial future, so to speak. And there's a best-case scenario, the blue one here, and I come back to that later. You see, these are the corresponding concentrations in the atmosphere. So with the RCP 8.5, you're going towards 2,000 ppm in the atmosphere, that is six times or so on the pre-industrial level, while with the best of all worlds regarding emission reductions, you would peak somewhere near 420 or so, something, or 450. Now, the interesting thing is now, what would it mean in terms of temperature? And that's why it's so important to go beyond 2,100. The climate system is a very slow system reacting in a highly nonlinear way. So if we would have something like 2 degrees warming by the year 2050, it would stay on the high-end scenario. You see, in 2100, yes, maybe 4 degrees warming above pre-industrial. That's the theme of the conference. But then you would go further than that, and it would be maybe 7.5 or 8 degrees in the year 2300. By the way, sea level will rise, of course, in parallel with that. So a warming of 2 degrees by 2100 may mean 7 meter sea level or 8 meter sea level rise in the year 2500 or something. It's a highly inert system. Now, with the best of all worlds in terms of climate protection, you would more or less scratch the 2 degrees line and then slowly, very, very slowly settle back to milder temperatures. And it would still take millennia to approach anything near the pre-industrial level. So it means the planet has been changed for good, more or less, so for the next 50,000 years when the next ice age is due, already by human action. But it makes a huge difference whether we sit on the blue fan or the red fan. The difference is human civilization, if you like. So how can we close this gap? Now going back actually now, since you have seen the temperature impact, let's revisit the best case scenario, the blue one. Now that tells you emissions of CO2 will peak around 2020, dramatically decline and reach the zero line around the middle of the century, and then turn negative for the rest of the century. Do I have to repeat this? Peak by 2020, decline steeply, and go negative. That means we will suck up carbon from the atmosphere with various techniques. Now, if you tell this inconvenient truth to policymakers, even if we sit in Germany or in the UK, their eyes are glazing over, as you can imagine, because it simply means we are already in a situation with the most dramatic of all climate protection scenarios. We can hold the 2 degrees line, which at the same time has been adopted by 194 nations. We have a new nation since last Sunday, Southern Sudan. They will rush to adopt the 2 degrees target, I'm pretty sure, although they don't know at all what it means. So we have this complete discrepancy, the psychologists would call it cognitive dissonance, between the target, which is now more or less a universal target, and the strategy we need in order to come near that. And again, let me remind you, it is the blue line which we have to consider. Now, compared to that, I will not mingle into Australian affairs, but if you just contrast the carbon tax, whatever it's called, with this epochal sort of complete sea change type transformation of the emission system, and you see we still have a long way to go. 2 degrees. Why 2 degrees? This is the burning embers diagram, as the late Steve Schneider called it. Actually, I invented this thing in the third assessment report when we did the synthesis chapter of the third assessment report working group on impacts and adaptation back in 2000, together with Rick Lehmans from Wageningen University, because we wanted to provide a semi-quantitative assessment of what it means if we go up the temperature line. So we used color coding, simply saying if you are in the white range, you could also pick green, of course. You are more or less okay. If you are in the yellow range, be careful. If you are entering the red zone, you are going to have big problems. And this was specified along 5 reasons for concern. Again, at that time, the third assessment report, it was completely politically incorrect to talk about dangerous climate change. Later on, I was the co-organizer of the Exeter Conference on Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change when we created this book with Cambridge University Press, came out in 2005, Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change. By that time, it was allowed to talk about dangerous, but it was just reason for concern. Now, if you do this, you see that if you go to ecosystems like coral reefs, if an additional 1 degree warming is very devastating, and I'm sure the evidence will be provided again here at this conference.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are listening to a keynote speech by Professor John Schellenhuber, director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. This recording comes from the 4 Degrees or More conference in Melbourne, Australia, held July 12th to 14th, 2011. Find all the lectures free at 4degrees2011.com.au. Let's return to this keynote speech.
Now, when it comes to the really big hits, like what we call tipping points events, the collapse of the Greenland ice sheet, destabilization of the Indian summer monsoon, and so on, and we probably have some leeway. Now, the 2 degrees line is sitting here. It's, in a sense, a very bad compromise. It's a compromise with nature. It just tells you along certain dimensions of concern or danger, 2 degrees is already too much. But we have a certain hope. If you go to the right-hand column, we have a certain degree of hope, at least, that we can avoid the big hits, namely nonlinear events in the Earth system, which are largely irreversible, large-scale, continental scale, cannot be undone, more or less. Once you melt down the Greenland ice sheet, as I said, you have to wait at least 50,000 years in order to reproduce it. That is when the next ice age is due, according to the Milankovic cycles. So that is the compromise with nature. I wanted to show you this. Malte Meinthausen actually has provided that, together with Parrett and other colleagues. I think that's a fascinating study. I showed some of his slides at the Vatican recently, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is having some 20 Nobel laureates, consists of 80 members only. So we met at the Vatican City, which was quite interesting, in particular because we had private access to Michelangelo's frescoes in the Sistine Chapel. That was probably the best conference I ever had. But apart from that, we produced a declaration for the Pope, and he's speaking for 1.5 billion people, so it's okay. This was about the injustice of sea level rise. That's really an extremely important point. Because if you pick any scenario, now here a scenario, one of these scenarios I showed, simply means on average you have about a meter sea level rise by 2100, that's more or less the central value we can expect, a meter of sea level rise all over the globe. But the funny thing is, and the very vicious thing is, that the sea level rise will be distributed in a highly inhomogeneous way across the planet. If you go along all the coastlines of the continents. Now, in particular, if a lot of that comes from Greenland, now, elementary physics. If Greenland is losing mass, that means its gravitational pull for seawater will be diminished. If you lose mass, you cannot attract. This is also true for human behavior, sometimes. Sometimes it's the other way around. This is not the theme of the conference, I know. But the gravitational pull will be diminished, and that means around Greenland, sea level may even drop, in particular for the northeastern part of the American continent. While there will be a sort of ridge of water, in particular in the Pacific, around the equator, and the Pacific Islands again, have done anything in order to contribute to global warming, will again get the brunt of it, will get all the water which is released from Greenland, for example. By those who are most responsible for that, Northern Europe, Northern America, and so on, will be spared sea level rise, at least for a while. So you see, nature can be extremely unfair if humanity is sort of provoking that injustice. Okay, same is true for a shift of biomes, so I'm sure you can do this for Australia. The interesting thing here simply is if you take various scenarios from the Max Planck Institute or for the Hadley Center, you get very different, very similar shifts in ecosystem behavior, very different shifts in biomes, so in particular forest and woodland decline. That is the sort of brownish color here in the United States here. So these are dramatic ecological shifts. And in particular, they come with dramatic changes in ecosystem services. Nobody has really calculated the costs of that so far, but I'm sure it's in the trillions. Here, this is a famous work by Ove, who is here at the conference. Just tells you that the oceans, in particular the tropical oceans, will find themselves squeezed in between warming, so with all the coral bleaching and so on, and acidification. And this morning I read a top-level intellectual newspaper, The Australian, here at breakfast. And I found a heartbreaking story about tourist companies operating at the Great Barrier Reef who complain about the carbon tax, that the diesel for shipping tourists to these wonderful, pristine places will increase in price, so the tourist industry will face collapse, but the collapse of the Great Barrier Reef as such doesn't seem to be a risk for them. Huh? And if you want to have a metaphor for the short-sightedness of people, you can find it in this fine newspaper here. By the way, interesting, I'm very much in general interested in non-linearities in the system, of threshold behavior, tipping points, and so on. What you find here, for example, for the United States, a recent work in Proceedings of the National Academy, 2009, tells you that, yes, and that is a sort of common pattern we found also in the IPCC, that for agricultural productivity in general, you have an increase up to 2 or 3 degrees warming, so to speak, and then you have a sharp decline if you go beyond that threshold. And that is, for example, here true for the United States. You have a fairly mild increase in productivity for certain crops, but then dramatically the productivity goes down. Now, this is very bad news because human beings in general and in industries always try to sort of, you know, explore opportunities until you enter a point of no return. That is precisely why we need scientific evidence here. And here is some work I just wanted to cite because Tony McMichael, friend of mine who is also here, I invited him at that time to write a commentary on that. This is now, if you like, the worst-case scenario. You know what I've shown you, 8 degrees warming or even more. What would it mean for the very survival of human beings as physiological entities? And this was a study done by medical researchers who just showed if the world would warm up in certain regions at least by 11 or 12 degrees, simply our physical subsistence would cease because we could not sweat enough in order to keep body temperature around 37 degrees. It would be absolutely impossible. So you would have to leave those regions. So 9 billion people sitting all in Canada or Sweden could become very uncomfortable. So tipping points, I will not dwell a lot on that. So that was a scheme. Actually, I introduced at a lecture at Oxford when I gave the Lineker lecture in 2001 in Oxford. I presented for the first time this type of map. Where are the system elements of the planetary machinery which can be switched into a different mode of operation by global warming, like destabilization of monsoon systems, deflection or shutdown of ocean currents like the North Atlantic thermaline oscillation, things like that. Of course, biome shifts. El Niño, Southern Oscillation, ice sheets, and so on. And very quickly, this was, I was invited by PNAS to do a special feature on that, so we collected some 10 papers on that, on tipping dynamics on Earth. Now, this is recent work by Potsdam Institute showing that with an additional warming between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees, so that is clearly the theme of the conference, there will be the beginning of the meltdown of the Greenland ice sheet. So if only for this very reason, the adoption of a 2 degrees target would make a lot of sense for the world. Because, you know, meltdown of Greenland over the long run means 7 meters sea level rise alone. The story is much more complicated if you go to, and Dave Griggs knows about that, who is in the room, if you go to biomes, that is the Amazon rainforest, where the Hadley Center model was predicting more or less the collapse of parts of it with global warming. Other models show less dramatic effects. But you see, if you have a cloud of predictions here, most of them point in the direction from rainforest to savanna. That is what science at best can tell you, it's including all the uncertainties, and we can be very proud, actually, as scientists, to present not the rainforest will collapse by the year 2087, but I tell you, this is the body of evidence. It's clumsy, it's cloudy, it is hazy, whatever, but Millions of hours of work have gone into producing that hazy picture, actually, and we're very proud of presenting that, including all the uncertainties. So if climate skeptics are out to get you, tell them our best weapon is that we're truthful to uncertainty in the debate. I always encounter that the people who attack you are completely certain about their case. Whatever you tell them, they know 100% they are right. I don't know whether I'm right, at least not 100%. I'm a skeptic regarding my own work every day. You always scrutinize what you have done yesterday, and you're never confident. So that type of cloudiness, if you like, is precisely what the best level of science has to achieve. In 2005, and even worse, not so much noticed, the Amazon had a large drought. 2010 was worse than 2005. So we're seeing the writing on the wall already. This is a work I've done together with my colleague Hoffmann in Potsdam, which came as a surprise, actually. We tried to study ocean acidification and the effects on ecosystems and so on. What we discovered is actually, because of less export of particle ballast and so on, it's a complicated modeling exercise, you find what we call oxygen holes in the Pacific and so on. Because there will be almost oxygen-free regions between 200 and 800 meters because of shoaling, stratification, but also less export of particles into the deep sea. And that came as a big surprise. Now it has been taken up, so it is not just when I talk about the future of our oceans that they will rise high, they will warm up, they will turn sour, but they will also lose breath. And finally, if you take into account in a worst case scenario, and again, this is just a scientific fiction so far, I talked about it at the Oxford conference, but meanwhile we have done some very serious work about it. Is there such a thing on Earth as a runaway greenhouse effect? We know such a thing is on Venus. Venus has embarked on a runaway greenhouse effect, so the average surface temperature 440 degrees centigrade, not 4 degrees centigrade, 440, the oceans have evaporated and so on, and you have a very CO2-thick atmosphere there. Can something like that ever happen on Earth? Of course, it will happen in 7 billion years from now, when the sun turns into a red giant. We can calculate this. Can it be triggered by humanity? I don't think so, but we may have discontinuities in the response of the Earth system to anthropogenic forcing. If you take into account, for example, the huge methane cleft rates on the ocean shelves, actually there is more fossil fuel stored there than in any other sources we have, coal, oil, everything combined. The other thing is the carbon which is stored in the Arctic soils, in particular methane, CO2, and so on. Now, we have embarked on a study together with Siberian colleagues who have the best data on that. How much is there in Siberia? It turns out that it's a lot, actually, and now I come back to the effect. Very simply put, the idea is that if you force the Earth system by an external perturbation to increase average temperature by, say, 2 degrees, and you release the system afterwards, will it sort of swing back? Of course, the overall temperature increase will be positive, so there will be an increase, but it may, through self-regulation, negative feedbacks, just go back by 1 degree or so on. Or will it self-amplify the perturbation, which what we call a positive feedback? Now, in general, you have a number of negative feedbacks. They are outlined here in green, and you have positive feedbacks. The most important of all the negative feedbacks, clearly, is the Stefan-Boltzmann radiative damping, which goes to the fourth power of global mean temperature. So it is, in the true sense of the word, very powerful, the fourth power, highly nonlinear. So if you increase the temperature of the Earth, and a lot of it gets lost by radiation into outer space, and there is a self-equilibration.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are hearing a keynote address mainly to scientists and experts in Australia. It was in July with the same disturbing assessment John Schellenhuber has given directly to many heads of government. Back to this talk by Professor Schellenhuber of the Potsdam Institute from the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia.
But could we enter a situation where we switch the temperature artificially by a few degrees, and then a system decides to amplify that perturbation and just run away? For example, by releasing methane from the oceans or from the Arctic soils. And we did that type of calculation, and what we found is that if you take various scenarios, and it's a complicated, more or less to be understood by quantum physicists. So in my former life, I was a quantum physicist, and maybe some in the room have heard about energy bands in a solid. That is the basis for all the smart transistor technology and so on. We wouldn't sit here, I couldn't speak with the microphone, you wouldn't have a computer and so on, were it not for these energy gaps in the band structure of electrons in a solid, in a periodic system. And it seems that we find something like a temperature gap in our calculation. That means according to the scenario, depending on the scenario we have, a certain temperature range cannot be sort of settled, if you like. So if we either have a warming, according to the feedback, which is something below 5 degrees or so on, or else it will be above 10 degrees. So this is very, very preliminary. If we can consolidate that, it is a almost mind-boggling result. But it simply would mean if you venture beyond a certain boundary, the system starts to self-amplify, a lot of positive feedback will kick in, and you simply cannot hold a temperature like 7 degrees above pre-industrial. Simply ruled out like certain energies in a solid. That is a fascinating scientific insight. It's less fascinating for humanity, I guess. Okay, let me conclude, more or less, yes. What can we do about it? Again, work by Malte Meinhausen, Miles Allen from Oxford and others have shown us a scientific way in order to calculate precisely what climate protection policy has to deliver globally. Now, if you take all the models together, you have a quasi-linear relationship between two entities. One is the expected global warming you get over the next 50 years or so on, and the other quantity you need to know simply is, and when it's a function of that, the cumulative emissions of greenhouse gases, in particular CO2. There's a quasi-linear relationship. In spite of all the non-linearities sort of dominating the Earth system, so you have carbon cycle, you have inertia in the ocean, but they all cancel more or less in order to provide you with that linear relationship. It makes things much easier because if you tell me humankind will emit, say, 1,000 billion tons of CO2 over the next 40 years. I can calculate on the back of an envelope, or even without the back of an envelope, maybe even in my mind, I can calculate, which is, okay, don't want to comment on that. I can calculate the warming, the resulting warming. Now you can turn that around, and it's very powerful. You could simply say, if 194 nations said 2 degrees maximum warming, how much carbon credit are we left with globally? And this is, of course, a probability discussion. As I said, we have a lot of the haze of uncertainties and so on. If we want to hold the 2 degrees line with a 2 in 3 probability, which is not brilliant, in general, I comment this by saying if you play Russian roulette, you have a better chance. Actually, who played Russian roulette here before? It's so disappointing. Whenever I ask this question, nobody raises his or her arm, although you have a 5 in 6 chance to survive, so you could play it at home. But this is not a scientific recommendation, by the way. I go to the next slide. Here it is, and that is what, in principle, the whole debate is all about. It is the critical decade we are living in now. If you assume we want to have a 2 in 3 chance to hold the 2 degrees line, avoiding all the strange encounters behind that fireball, which I sketched briefly, when we are left with about 750 gigatons of carbon dioxide between 2010 and 2050, over the next 40 years. The question is how to spend it. Now, this is a global emissions profile. Now we are beyond the 30 gigatons already, 30 billion tons. And the question is how to spend now the remaining carbon budget. And it's an integral, of course. You know, the integral, the number is the area under the curve. Now, the curve can be bent in whatever way. You have a lot of flexibility. But the area always has to be the same. Now, 3 scenarios. If we would have peaking in global emissions, that means Copenhagen would have been a dramatic success. When we could follow that path here, you see, a fairly mild phase-out of CO2, that means we spend the carbon budget this way, something is still left in 2050, and the maximum reduction rate would be 3.7% per year, which is already a lot. If you wait just another 4 years, 2050, and that's the tyranny of the integral, if you like, what you overshoot here, you have to chip away afterwards, so we would have already about 1 Kyoto Protocol per year to deliver. 1 Kyoto Protocol fully established per year. But if we wait until 2020, and that's about the best and the most optimistic scenario, narrative of climate protection policy we can think of, when we would have reduction rates of about, at maximum, of 9% per year. Now, this is the task we challenge right now. Now, compare it to the carbon tax here in Australia. I think 5% reduction in 2020 as compared to 2005, that's insignificant. It does not mean it's not a necessary measure, by the way. That will be my last comment. Anyway, so we did a lot of calculations. In the end, it simply means would you spend the carbon credit with nature among the nations of the world? And so we did, apart from this very sobering exercise, 750 gigatons left, how do you spend it over the next years? And I showed you sort of peaking of emissions is absolutely crucial before 2020. But the other thing is the question of justice. This simply means if you distribute the budget, the integral, so to speak, over all nations of the world on an equal per capita basis. Simply means every person, every man, every woman, in the future at least, has the same right to use the atmosphere. Sounds logical, I think. I think Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, was the first one to introduce this as a general principle of justice. So I talked to the German Chancellor about it. She knows Kant very well. You always have to start with a philosopher if you talk to politicians, you know. And then you end up with physics. Yeah, she is actually a believer in that. She even renewed that at a conference we had a week ago. If you distribute it on an equal per capita basis, then, of course, this means what it means for the various countries of the world, because it means you have to go down in your per capita emissions radically. By the way, the area under the curve, so this is black for the United States of America, these are per capita emissions, If you distribute it according to an overall justice principle, blue is Germany, the areas under the curve are always the same. Everybody has to spend the same carbon budget, but you can choose how to do it. And it would mean, according to that scheme, the US would be carbon bankrupt in the year 2020. India could go on almost forever. Burkina Faso has not even started to emit. But these are the countries who will see the most severe impacts, clearly. I mean, this is not doable. We all know that. I mean, when I presented this to some members of Obama's administration, several ministers included, and so on, you can imagine how the reaction was. At least I was allowed to leave the country. I had a narrow escape, though. But, of course, the general comment, actually even from journalists, was, well, the U.S. Senate will never approve of that. So that was the reaction. Of course, the U.S. Senate will never approve of it. What we could do, and that relates to Australia's debate, understand that you are not introducing a carbon tax as such, but you are introducing an emissions trading system in the long run. A flexible economic instrument, which is, of course, much favorable. And what we did is calculating here, if you distribute this carbon credit among the three blocks of nations, you know, the industrialized countries in red, the emerging economies like China in yellow, and the developing countries, including India in this case, when you would have these decarbonization curves. But if you include now a trading of emissions, it's a bit complicated, but just focus on the solid lines, which more or less converge towards 2050. It means if you would trade about 140 gigatons of carbon from allowances, actually, from India to the United States and so on, when we could all converge to the same per capita emissions in 2050. So it's doable, and we calculated what it would cost. It costs about $100 billion per year transfer from south to north, which sounds absolutely fair. It's almost nothing compared to the global GDP, for example. So it can be done if you are willing to let the market unroll and unfold its forces. The funny thing is that if you talk to market liberals, they are the strongest opponents to that in general. Very strange, but I'm a plain simple physicist. I cannot understand that. Finally, because I'm coming from Germany now. Now in Germany, something very strange happened. The government was embarking on an extension of lifetime for nuclear energy. We have 17 nuclear power plants. And after Fukushima, complete U-turn happened. And it was pledged that there will be a phase-out of nuclear power plants by 2022 without giving up our climate goals. That means 40% reduction of CO2 emissions or carbon emissions as compared to 1990 levels by 2020. 40%, that is quite dramatic. And that can only be achieved if you give up on nuclear and at the same time you honor your climate pledges, if you have an aggressive build-up of renewable energies and much higher energy efficiency standards. So, the ballpark numbers are, by 2050, Germany wants to cut its primary energy consumption in half. Although we are an industrialized country and number two in export values in the world and so on. And 80% of the electricity has to come from renewables by then. So you see here on this chart simply how the narrative goes. On the left-hand side, 2010, you have the old energy system, coal and oil and so on, and it turns colorful without the brownish parts of it in 2050 here. It all can be done. We did the physical and chemical and engineering calculations. It all can be done. It comes with extra costs of maybe 10 euro per household a month. But many people think this is too costly to save the planet. Thank you very much.
Hello. It's a reasonably gloomy scenario that you paint. Should Australians have any cause for optimism? I know you've just arrived in the country in an environment where there's been some fairly big new measures that have been introduced by the government in the last few days. Given that your scenario is a relatively pessimistic scenario into the future, should we have here in Australia some cause for optimism about setting a carbon price here and eventually or within 3 years moving to an emissions trading scheme domestically?
Now, first of all, I was asked by the organizers here to give more or less the scientific backdrop, you know, the global picture about non-linearities and what it would mean if you go beyond the 2 or 3 or 4 degrees. So only in passing, more or less, I made these comments on the energy system and so on. No, actually, I think there is a lot of reason for optimism. I'm not so knowledgeable regarding the detail of this carbon tax, although I looked into on the government website where it is explained that it seems to be an interesting package, at least with a number of good elements. They are all not ambitious enough, clearly. Yeah? But in Germany, we had a similar story, actually. I mean, the bottom line is the challenge, the physical challenge of climate change we're facing is really probably the biggest of the 21st century. I tried to underpin this statement with a number of charts and assessments. On the other hand, our innovation potential is also unprecedented in the 21st century. Yeah? It will be a race between what we're doing to the environment and how we unleash the forces of innovation, actually. And it seems if you take it all together, then we have a fair chance, actually, to still solve the problem, at least in a regional context. And if Germany is embarking, using, of course, wind energy, photovoltaics, solar thermal, and so on, geothermal, on completely transforming its energy system, I think Australia is actually in a much, much better situation to do that. If you fly across this country, I mean, 95% of the area is unused in any way. I mean, you have it's bathed in sunshine all the time. For me, it's, and actually everybody outside Australia, it's unbelievable that solar energy doesn't play a much bigger role here. Huh? And of course, I know that selling coal to China and so on seems to be a safe bet for the future, but one shouldn't be too sure about that bet, because I know the Chinese pretty well. I talked to many of the top officials, and you should not depend on the dependence of others, actually. Yeah? That is a fairly stupid strategy, because, of course, China does not want to import coal forever from Australia. First of all, we have a lot of coal in their own grounds, actually. It's simply too expensive to ship it, actually, from the western part to the eastern part. It's cheaper to have it shipped from Brisbane or wherever. That's the logic of economics, but that will change in the future. And also we have a massive program to go into renewables. So 17 Chinese ministers came to visit Germany 2 weeks ago. We had a joint cabinet meeting, one of the big issues. So that happened for the first time. And the Chinese have never done that before to any country. It was all about innovation in the energy mix and so on. And we call it the emergence of a fitness club for the 21st century, with just two members here, Germany and China. Why shouldn't Australia become the third member? It would be fairly easy to do so.
That was Professor Hans Joachim Schellenhuber, also known as John. The speech was titled Strange Encounters Behind the 2 Degrees Firewall. It was a keynote presentation for experts at the conference 4 Degrees or More in Melbourne, Australia in July 2011. You can find all the conference speeches, including 2 important videos, at the website 4degrees2011.com.au. The science is so new, and the world we are flipping into, almost without knowing it, has a climate and ecology unknown to humans now or ever in our history. I filled half a binder with notes from this Australian conference. Help yourself at 4degrees2011.com.au. We all need to go back to school, to learn, and then pass it on to teach others, to tell our neighbors, while there is still time to save our climate. And there is still time, if we can make a miracle, if we can change. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We are out of time for this week. Find more notes on John Schellenhuber and the conference in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Download all our past programs, including many interviews with top climate scientists, at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for being brave enough to listen. Tune in next week.